We are starting a new topic today. It's an important topic for the next couple of weeks. And we're going to talk, first time ever, for a whole sermon about digital Christianity, or in other words, social media and Christian living. How to be a Christian. Now, here's the thing. If you've been around long enough, you know this. Once in a while, when we're preaching about how to behave ourselves as Christians with other people, we'll bring up the idea of how we behave on social media within that sermon. But we've never spent an entire sermon or a few sermons specifically only on social media and Christianity. But it's important. And so we're going to do it for the next couple of weeks. It's important because we are in the middle of a crazy year, and it's an election year, and it's a crazy year. I remember watching, the world has changed so much digitally. Technology has made everything so accessible. We have so much information at our fingertips that we never had before. I think we have more information than human brains were ever had to comprehend in the history of the world, all around us just pouring in so much information that it's almost no information at times. And we're not only informationally connected better than ever, but we're socially connected better than ever. And so I noticed a number of years ago, about the 2012 election season, I was watching the angst of social media growing. And in 2012, I watched kind of, it got a little uglier than usual. Like that kind of ramped up noticeably on my radar that year. And then it kind of faded back into normal because you know how politics goes. And we're not speaking on politics or certain political parties today. We're talking about social media largely. But it will pertain, unfortunately, to politics. And about 2016 rolls around, and we weren't ready for the mayhem that was technology, next cycle, and how all, I mean, I remember walking in thinking, oh, these are harmless conversation topics. And then all of a sudden, it's like people are ending friendships of a lifetime and insulting it, and it was just like lines are in the sand, and you know, it was just, it got ugly. And sometime in 2017, I sat down with our team, and I said to them, we have got to get ahead of this thing in 2020 because this is getting worse. We got to talk about this, man, because I have been embarrassed by Christians getting caught up in the political culture of our day and age and how we forget who we're supposed to be, what we are, being ugly people. We got to talk about this in 2020. That was our plan. We all nodded and agreed. And then 2020 happened. Holy cow. Who saw this year coming, you know? And we had COVID and this and that, and it was nuts around here. And so we're like, well, let's kind of change our game plan for what we're going to preach about for a little bit for the spring. And then the summer series came, and before the time the summer series was over, you know, people were so done with COVID and over that, and political season was full on and swinging. I feel like we're late to the party again. Like, we should have been talking about this stuff weeks ago, and we're late to the party again. So the question becomes, how do we miss our chance to get ahead of the angst of this stuff? And so we got to try again in 2024 to try and get ahead of the curve a little bit. But we're going to talk about digital Christianity, social media, and what it means to be a Christian in a social media culture that we live in today. Now, some of you are not on social media. Some of you don't have Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or Snapchat or any of that. And if that's you, you can sit back and say, you're going to be sitting back today and saying, this is why I don't have that stuff. Amen, preacher. Get the rest of those people. Again, you're going to enjoy this, okay? You're going to sit back and pop popcorn and grin at the rest of us for a few minutes, okay? But for the rest of us, you know, this is what we need to hear. And here's what I want to say about speaking about this subject. This is a biblical and spiritual topic, whether or not it's convenient to our behavior or preferences. Because I learned something in 22 years of pastoring, that spiritual sermons are sermons that happen to be things that I agree with and I like. Church people don't like their stuff getting preached against. When we want the preacher to preach hard about sin and stuff, we want it to be somebody else's sin and stuff, not ours, you know? So whenever they gets up there and he messes with how we do things, it's like, hold on now, that's not what we want to hear. And I remember through 22 years of pastoring through the years, hearing people periodically will say something like, that wasn't very spiritual sermon today. And the best analogy I can give you is that when you throw a rock into a flock of birds, you kind of always know which one you hit by how loud it cries afterwards. And through the years of pastoring, what's happened is people come up to me and I'll just preach a sermon and I don't think that's very spiritual. And what I've learned is usually it is spiritual. It's a biblical topic. It just wasn't one they wanted to hear. And so that's how this goes. So here's the thing. We're going to take this ride for 2 or 3 weeks. Now, I'm going to tell you before we start today, this is going to be a 3-week conversation, but it's going to be one gigantic sermon. In other words, if you were to come, I could do this all in 1 week. We're not doing it in 1 week because we'd be here till 3 o'clock this afternoon, and Vitos has to open up before then, right? So we don't have time to do that. So here's the thing. We don't have time for a gigantic one. So we're going to break this up into three pieces, three parts. But it's kind of one big topic. And so if it was one big sermon, you'd have your part where we talk about here's the problem, here's the tension about the problem we've got to deal with, and then here's the scriptural view on what we're trying to do, and then over here is the solution of how we're supposed to practically go forward. That'd be one sermon. The problem is I'm doing this in three parts, which means it's going to feel a little disjointed in the sense of we're going to talk about maybe more of the problem 1 week, maybe more of the pragmatic side 1 week, maybe more of this, you know, the spiritual verses side 1 week. And so it's going to be all over the place. In fact, because we're doing this one big talk in three parts, like one big sermon in 3 weeks, this week will be maybe if you're critical of the topic because it doesn't settle well with where you are, this will be the week you can easily criticize today as not sounding very spiritual, because it might not sound very spiritual before we're done. But it's just part one of three. And here's what I'm going to ask you to do today. I'm going to ask you to give me 3 weeks before you write me off. Okay? And the other week, you can sit there and say, he's an idiot, he's a fool. You know, you can tell me that was the worst sermon series I've ever heard in my entire life. You're wrong, Arlen, and do better next time, or I'm not coming back anymore because of it, or whatever it may be. But give me 3 weeks. Because even if you walk away, we need to understand. I want us to understand what it is we're resisting. But I need 3 weeks to unpack it. So here we go. To get us started, by way of introduction, we're going to examine today largely, again, we won't feel very spiritual, we're going to examine some terminologies today. Terminologies that deal with things that happen in a world that's different than it used to be. The world's changed. It's not 1885 anymore. It's not 1985 anymore. It's like everything is digital and connected, and we have probably people online off most weeks. I don't know if we do today or not. We're watching from the other side of the planet. You know, I mean, we're all connected in different ways than we usually are. It's crazy, and because of it, it's changed everything. And so the sociological behaviors and the sociological problems within our behaviors have changed. See what I'm saying? New technology has made the world seem smaller and has created different sociological problems. And because of that, this is a different topic than it was a while back. We're going to explain some terms that describe our social digital behaviors. Now, before I get into those, how many of you growing up, or maybe you're older than me, so this was after you were grown, how many of you, when you were younger, used to watch the television show Little House on the Prairie a long time ago? Okay, we have some Little House watchers, okay? My hand's up because when I was growing up, I was a preacher's kid. We didn't always even have a TV. When we did, we only allowed to watch certain shows. Well, the kids were only allowed to watch certain shows. My parents, I'd have to sneak downstairs and watch between the banister rails at night what they were watching. But anyhow, or sneak downstairs in the morning and turn on my favorite shows that I wasn't allowed to watch. But anyhow, another story. But we were allowed to watch Little House on the Prairie, right? That was our show we were allowed to watch. And so we loved it. And so in that show, if you've watched it before, and if you haven't watched it before, you're missing out. It's still on TV today. It's the longest running TV series consecutively for decades ever. It's still on some networks to this day. But in that show, it was based upon the books written by Laura Ingalls Wilder about the Ingalls family, and kind of the main character. They were the main stars, especially her dad, Charles Ingalls, played by Michael Landon, and Laura Ingalls, played by Melissa Gilbert. And the Ingalls family were the good guys. And in the town, you had your antagonist. And your main antagonist, the main bad guy, was the mercantile owner's wife, Harriet Olson. She was the bad guy. I mean, she was always wrong. She was always bad. And she just was mean and horrible. And they had kids, and their kids. I mean, that poor husband, the mercantile owner, Nels Olson, was the nicest guy in the world. But he was married to crazy and gave birth to crazy. And they had a daughter named Nellie Olson. And Nellie Olson was the absolute worst of all. And so while the Ingalls family, Laura Ingalls and others, they might mess up sometimes and do something wrong sometimes because everyone's human, they were still the one. They would always get redeemed in the end. They'd make things right. They'd apologize. They would end up being the good guys always. But Nellie Olson was always the bad guy because there was good guys and there was just bad guys. And we think, and a lot of TV shows were made that way. In today's day and age, a lot of your TV shows are not that way anymore. It's very gray. You're not sure where the good guys and the bad guys stop and start anymore, right? Like, these are the good guys, but they seem kind of corrupt. And these are the bad guys, but I kind of understand why, and I'm kind of cheering for them, you know? I mean, it's like, it's a different world in TV than it used to be. But in those days, shows like that, you knew who the bad guy was. It was Nellie Olson. You know, that's how that was. And but that's not how life works, because it's just not that simple. People aren't also clearly easy to define. But we let, you know, sometimes entertainment make us think that way. To quote Alexander Solzhenitsyn, say that name three times fast, he once made it said this way. He said, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But, he said, the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. The problem is that it's not that clear cut. But we think it is, because to us, there's good and bad, and we're always the good guys. We even read our Bibles that way. Like, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. And when we read the Bible, we look for the good guys and the bad guys, right? In fact, when you read the, I know Christians a long time, we read the book of Psalms, and it's like, God bless the righteous, that will be me and us. And God punish the bad, that would be them, you know? And so, and we resonate with the good people in the stories as us, and their antagonists are the other people in our lives, because there's good guys and bad guys. So clear cut, right? But it's not so easy. In fact, it's an interesting thing, in Jesus' day, 2,000 years ago, when you read the New Testament, the bad guys of Jesus' day really would be offended to be told that, because they really believed with all of their heart they were the good guys. It was the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the religious people. Think about this. The people in Jesus' day that were the bad people it was the God crowd. It was the people who, don't miss it, it was the people who read their Bibles, memorized their scriptures, went to church, went to the temple. It was the temple attending, scripture memorizing, Bible reading, God crowd. They loved God and they loved their nation, and they wanted to see Israel restored to its former greatness. And they were pro their nation, they were pro their God, and they were in the church house, and they were, right? And they were the bad guys. But how could you be the bad guy? I mean, we read that, we're like, those bad people. But in their day, they'd be us. We identify with the good guy of the story, but they'd be us. They're the ones who go to church on Sunday. They're the ones who learn the scriptures and memorize and think that we're better and we're the right side and everyone else is wrong, and our views and our love for our God and nation are right. And it's so easy to not see the bad guy in ourselves, because they didn't. And they fought Jesus, because Jesus came along and he talked to people who were far from him, people that they had alienated from them in their own country because they were the wrong ones. And God comes along and tells these religious people, I'm not playing your game. He begins to minister to those other people. And talks, and boy, and they got mad at him. They fought him because they fought Jesus the way that we today fight religious leaders who don't toe the religious party line. You know? We get mad because they're supposed to we want them to be about what we're about. And the Pharisees wanted Jesus to be about what they were about, but he wasn't. He was about the people who needed him, who wanted him, who needed hope. And so they fought Jesus, and they were critical. And they, in fact, if you turn to Matthew 12 and read it later on, we don't have time to read the whole chapter, but he kept unraveling their religious arguments. They became unhinged. The religious crowd became so unhinged because they loved God. And who's this guy messing up what we do? And he's ruining everything, and he doesn't know what he's doing. And they were so angry at him, they became unhinged and began to accuse him of the most false, exaggerated, dishonest, horrible things in vicious assaults to tear him down because he was wrong, because he wasn't toting their line. And Jesus has to answer their questions, and he says this to them in Matthew 12 and verse 33. Jesus says a tree is identified by its fruit. If a tree is good, its fruit will be good. If a tree is bad, its fruit will be bad, right? So we get upset by the fruit. We're like, that fruit is bad. But the problem is not the fruit. The problem is the tree that's producing the fruit. And Jesus explains, he says in verse 34, you brood of snakes. Now I want to pause here and say this. Every once in a while I've met some very angry Christians who are very rude and say rotten things to other people that they don't agree with. And they'll say, well, that's how Jesus was. He was pointed. I want to remind you of something very important. When Jesus in the Bible was this pointed and this sharp, it was never to people who were far from him. As far as, well, it was, but it wasn't to people who were not religious. It wasn't to the people that everyone would call sinners. It wasn't to the other side of the religious aisle. He was gracious to people. The people that Jesus was disappointed with was always the religious, church-going, God-loving, Israel-loving, scripture-memorizing, Bible-reading crowd who thought that they had a corner on God and thought they were better than all their people. That was the crowd that Jesus was always pointed with every single time. So if we want to talk about, you know, being pointed, we got to start with where was Jesus aiming his shots at? It was always aiming at people who claimed to represent him and did a very lousy job of showing his love to the world around them. And Jesus says to these guys, you brood of snakes. Whew, ouch. How could evil men like you speak what is good and right? He makes a statement that I want us to remember for later on. He says, for whatever is in your heart determines what you say. We won't come back to this verse for a long time, so I want us to remember that phrase, whatever is in your heart determines what you say. In fact, I want us all to say it together out loud, even if you're watching online, if you don't mind saying it in your living room or your kitchen or wherever, and in this room, let's all say this together in yellow. Ready? Whatever is in your heart determines what you say. One more time. Ready? Whatever is in your heart determines what you say. That's what Jesus said. And he goes on and says in verse 35, he says, a good person produces good things from the treasury of a good heart. And an evil person produces evil things from the treasury of an evil heart. Why? Because what's in our heart determines what we say. And then he says this, and I tell you this, you must give account on judgment day for every idle word you speak. Or if you're speaking in today's culture, he could say, for every idle word you type, post. Right? I mean, boy, that's pointed, isn't it? Ouch. Wow. But here's the thing he said next. This is so important. The words you say will either acquit you or condemn you. Or the things you post, right, will either acquit you or condemn you. The issue is the heart. The issue is the heart. Here's what I want to say. There's not a sermon series that I've done probably in a long time that I feel more passionate for than this one. Not because I'm not passionate for everything we say, but because I feel like we're on the pulse of something that we've got to identify in the American church. It's a different beast than biblical Christianity. It's more like 2,000 years ago religious Pharisaicalism. It believes we're the God crowd, but is so far from the heart of God, it's not funny. But again, that's hard to hear. I need 3 weeks to unpack my story. But for today, before we can fully address the issue of the heart, we need to examine the factors at play. These are important in understanding why things are the way they are. So I'm going to get very, again, this won't sound so spiritual for a while here, but this is the beginning. I'm going to give you some terminologies that all of us need to be familiar with. All of us need to know. Terminologies that might have never heard before. Terminologies that you may have heard before. You know, right? You may have heard them, but you don't really know how to apply them. Or maybe we apply them to other people, but not ourselves. And I want to give us these terminologies because in a digital day and age, this is not 1985 anymore. This is not 2005 anymore. We need to understand this stuff. And if we can understand this stuff, here's why. He gets to the heart. Because here's what I've learned. Jesus is not just chewing out these people in Matthew 12. He's not just saying, you're bad. He's saying to them, you're speaking wrong because your heart is messed up. But something else the Bible teaches us over and over again is that what affects our heart is what we take into our eyes and in our ears. In other words, what I read and listen to and read and listen to and hear and see and read and hear and see, it affects my heart. And my heart determines what I say. So if we're going to help us speak better, we can't sit there and say, don't say that anymore. Don't talk that way. Don't behave that way. Don't be that way. We can sit there and say, why is our heart that way? And our heart's that way because of what we're taking in. So we're going to identify some ideas today in a digital world, sociological terms, that I want you to understand if you've never heard it before or you have, so that we understand the things that are affecting our heart, and our heart determines what we say and what we do. So here's the terms. Bear with me. Let's go. First one is tribalism. What is tribalism? Well, tribalism is belonging to a tribe. In other words, back in the days, of old times across the globe, a tribe is a group of people that lived together in close community, and therefore they depended on each other, they co-opted together, and they defended each other from other groups of people. They formed a tribe. It was because we, you know, 20 miles from us a long time ago was a long ways away, because you just didn't hop into your Uber and take a quick drive somewhere, right? So tribalism was that people lived close by, they worked together, they defended each other, they formed tribes. In all cultures, all places, all parts of the world. Today speaking, it's different because we're not so scattered. We have technology today that, like I said, allows people across the globe to communicate with each other. So tribalism digitally becomes a whole different baby. Tribalism is a way of thinking or behaving in which people are loyal to their social group above all else. A way of thinking or behaving in which people are loyal to their social group above all else. Now, here's what happens. And this is a big deal. Because in tribalism, this derogatorily turns into a type of discrimination or animosity based upon group differences. Because we are identifying loyalty with a certain social group, we have animosity towards people of different groups. They're just bad. They're just the bad guys. Arr! Why is that animosity there? Why is that discrimination there? Why do we get that way? Because of tribalism. You say, yeah, but, you know, but again, in ancient times, tribalism was something different. Tribalism in ancient times was you lived close to the same people, so you had to work together. But in the digital day and age, ideology is the new geography. Ideology is the new geography. In other words, I can now align with people who live far from me, but see the world through the same lens I see it. And so tribalism now becomes, you agree with me politically or religiously or sports-wise, whatever it may be, we're lined up together, we're mad about the same stuff, we agree the same things medically, whatever it may be, we're ideologically together, and so we are a tribe. And tribalism happens ideologically in today's day and age more so than geographically. Which leads to another problem that happens in culture besides tribalism. The next problem is called zero sum. You've heard someone say it's a zero-sum game. What does zero-sum mean? Zero-sum is relating to or denoting a situation in which whatever is gained by one side is lost by the other. So in other words, what happens in a zero-sum game is for our side to gain, zero side is losing. What's gained by one side is lost by the other. In other words, in a zero-sum game, nobody can come together and everyone wins. In a zero-sum game, you can't compromise some things to make everything better and everyone comes out benefited. In a zero-sum game, I got to get ahead means you got to go down. I got to get ahead means you got to pay the price. It's a zero-sum game. Now, here's the thing. Competitively, if you understand sports, competitively speaking, it looks like this. I can't win unless you lose. I can't win unless you lose. That's what happens in a zero-sum game. I can't win unless you lose. So we understand this in sports because I like football. Football's coming up here. Go Colts, I'm sorry. But anyhow, I like football, and what happens is this. My team, in order to win, means your team has to lose. In fact, on the field right now, I got to get a touchdown, which means that we get ahead and you guys are losing. Or you want to get some points that we stop you because we can't let you have any. Even on a set of downs, my goal in this play is to get a first down, which means you're losing yardage for me to gain yardage. See, I can't win unless you lose. That's how sports work. And that's awesome. That's why we like sports, because they're competitive. It's fun. It's rah-rah. Some of us like sports anyhow. But that's how it works. The problem is we translate this idea, zero-sum idea, into other parts of life. It affects our communities, our church cultures, our neighborhoods, our nation, our politics becomes I can't win unless you lose. That a situation that I gain by you losing. So there can be no other way. And so in sports, we never get upset when we cheer for our sports teams. We never get mad. Okay, we get mad when the other side cheats or gets an unfair advantage or a call goes their way. That's not fair. We never get mad when the call goes our way. When we get an unfair advantage, we never get upset by that. I'm not upset by that. Like, you'll never see, you know, players upset. You know, fans are furious. Basketball playoffs are on right now, right? You're never going to see a basketball player going over to the ref and saying, "Ref, that's not fair. I fouled him and you didn't call me. I fouled him." You know, you never hear that. You never hear somebody saying, "No, timeout. We went out of bounds. It's their ball, not ours. That's not fair." Because we don't mind the advantages that work in our favor, because it's a zero-sum game. I got to win. So, hey, if the advantages become unfair my way and the calls go my way, that's life. And hey, they owed us one because they've been calling them against us all day. But if it goes their way, I'm upset. In fact, some of you know this because some of you live with a sports fanatic, or you are the sports fanatic who sits at your TV and half the game, you're saying, "Those refs are out to get our team." Right? Everyone in the world thinks the refs are out to get their team. You could have 17 more penalties called against the other team than they called against your team. Somehow the refs are still out to get your team. Because it's a zero-sum game. And that's fine in sports. Sports are stupid. I love them. They're stupid awesome. But that's not a way to live. And some of us, we've lived that way, and we politic that way, and we try to run a nation that way, and a church, and a community, and jobs. It's all, I got to win, so you got to lose. I got to get ahead, so you got to go down. And we feel that tension. My advantage means your loss. And therefore, here's what it means. It means that if I see you gaining an advantage, if I see you getting ahead at some point in your life, and you're not in my tribe, the zero-sum game tells me if you're getting ahead, it means that I must be losing, and I'm going to live out of fear and anger. I'm going to resent that because you can't get ahead, or I must be losing. And I've got to get ahead. I've got to make you lose so I can get ahead. You see, we can't handle that, right? We're very territorial in the tribalism. In fact, they oftentimes say that blood is thicker than water. You've heard that growing up, blood is thicker than water. I got a better one for you for the broader community. Besides blood is thicker than water, here's a new one. Tribe trumps truth. That it doesn't matter about the tribe, about the truth. It's the tribe. Tribes are important. We got to win. So if the truth hurts us, we're just going to ignore that. And if falsehood hurts them, well, we'll spread falsehood. That's okay, because truth doesn't matter. Tribe matters. It's a zero-sum game. We got to win, so tribe will trump truth every time. Now, can I tell you the honest truth? That's a powerful statement. I wanted to give it to you, but I almost didn't put it on the screen. I wrestled all the way till Friday of putting this important statement on the screen, and I was afraid to do it. You know why I was afraid? Because the word Trump is in it. Because I knew that if I put the word Trump in it, some of you would be like, "Yeah, Trump!" And others of you would be like, "Grr, Trump!" And both sides are going to shut down the whole point and be either happy or mad about the middle word and miss the truth of the sermon. Miss the truth of the sermon because of our tribe. Right? Because we don't care about the truth. We care about our tribe. It's a zero-sum game. We got to win. And the only way we can win is if they lose. How are we doing today? Let's talk about silos for a minute. What are silos? Silos are where you put your grain, silly. That's where silos are, don't you know? Farmer Jones has a silo on his 40 acres, and Farmer Smith has another one on his 40 acres. It contains their grain, and it keeps the other guy from getting their grain because it's contained in their silo, because grain's going to be safe there. You don't see grain, like, getting out of the silo, walking with other grain. Let's join the other silo over here. So silos are places where the grain's stored, and it's kept separate. But that's in farming terms. In sociological terms, what a silo is it's a colloquial term to illustrate division that prohibits interaction between disparate entities or groups. So what silos do is they keep us from interacting with people who are in opposite views. And what happens in culture, and this is what happened in digital culture to the world we live in today, is people who are all good humans trying to figure it out who have slightly different ideas, or sometimes big different ideas, but both want the best. Find the divides get pushed bigger into chasms by the culture around them, and that people notice that the people on the other side of their issue who are the worst players on the other side of the issue, make them mad at everyone on that side of the issue and justify them to go further this way, and then the bad players on their side of the issue cause people to say they're all bad and go further this way, and then we get more, and then if you're not where I am at, then you want to destroy the world, and you're trying to ruin everything if you don't see it my way, and we become pushed further and further into polarization until we're sitting in our own little silos, and we can't cross the great gulf fixed between us. And all that we're hearing is people who think the same way we think, telling us how bad the other side is, and we don't even listen to the other side anymore. Here's what we do. We're like, don't listen to the other side. but here's a few things. We want to show you some of the most stupid things about the other side. Aren't they stupid? Aren't they evil? And then, don't listen to them, but we'll tell you what they really believe, and here's how you answer. Here's how you argue against it really well. Go you. And we're like, yeah. And we're in ourselves, and we don't know how to communicate, and we lose each other. Here's what's happened on social media. Here's what happens to many of us on Facebook and other places. People quit talking to each other. Some of us, we've been so in our silo and so a lot about things that we're so angry and hacked off about all the other dumb people in the world, not like us. They're either evil or stupid or both. That the people in the other places, they stopped listening to us. People have stopped listening to us. They like either unfriended us or we unfriended them or... And so you might not know this, but they have unfollowed us. There's the people that you can mute somebody. There are people I love dearly, but I've had to just unfollow them. They're friends on Facebook, but I don't follow them because seeing their newsfeed breaks my heart. And so what happens is people get in a silo and they push away people who are, they basically say, if you're not where I'm at, even if you don't agree with me on everything, then you're as bad as the craziest people on the other side of my issues because you don't hate them as much as I hate them. Because you support them on some level, you're as bad as all of them are. And the people on the other side are saying, yeah, if you support this at all, then you're as bad as the worst players over there. And we're just so far away that we stopped listening. And people on the other side of the issues don't even hear what we're saying. They've muted us. They've unfollowed us. So the only people that we're speaking to are people in our silo. We're like, rah! And they're like, yeah! You know? We're like, this is how I feel. And we're applauding each other in the silo. But no one's listening outside of it. And you know how hard it is to leave a silo? It's why grain's not walking down the road with other grain joining the other farmer's silo. It's hard to do. Because in silos, there's no reward for changing. You are where you are. You're stuck with a crowd. You're stuck with, they're your fans. The other people are tuning you out. And if a person ever wakes up one day and says, oh no, I'm in a silo, and they try to do something about it, it's very hard to leave, and here's why. Because the reward of being in a silo is that we have a bunch of people around us who are, we preach to the choir, and they preach to us, and we all applaud each other, and we all get each other mad and worked up, and yeah! And then what happens is if you ever wake up and say, wait a minute, we're wrong about this issue, or we're wrong about the whole thing, or we need to have a better attitude at least, if we ever try to make a move a different direction, there's no reward. And here's why. Because the people on the other side who might say, oh wow, what a nice step you took, aren't listening to us anymore because we've alienated them. They're not hearing us anymore. They've shut us out a long time ago. And the people who have our attention are mad that you're making that position. So they're not going to cheer you. They're going to be very quiet and ignore you and give you the cold shoulder or even criticize and correct you. And you're trying to step away from the silo of a man. It's a very lonely no man's land. And then what happens is this. When you're sitting in that space, at some point, because you're still near that silo, you're gonna hear all that news and all that information again to the point where all of a sudden you get pulled back into it and you say something controversial and your silo's like, yeah, you're back with us again, good job. And the rewarded behavior for all of us is staying in our silo and it's so hard to leave. I'm gonna tell you something. I have watched people I love so dearly have moments of clarity where they're like, man, I'm supposed to be a Jesus follower. I'm supposed to be about the gospel. And I have gotten stuck up in the wrong band. I've let culture get me all worked up about lesser things. And I've driven people away from me. And I know it's wrong. And I got to do better. And they've tried to do better. And I used to get excited, but it won't last. Give them about 1 week of having this moment, come to Jesus moment, and step away from that silo mentality. And it's such a lonely place because no one they came from is cheering them on anymore. And no one on the other side even knows they exist yet because they've ran them off a long time ago. And so it's just lonely. So eventually they get sucked right back into the anger and the rage and the frustration because we can't help ourselves. It's so hard to leave a silo. And what it becomes next is it becomes an echo chamber. You know what an echo chamber is? An echo chamber, practically speaking, is this. It's an enclosed space where sound reverberates. Right? That makes sense? Like a silo, by the way. An enclosed space where sound reverberates. Hello, hello, hello. You know, it just bounces around the same sound all the time, right? An enclosed space where sound reverberates. Sociologically speaking, an echo chamber is an environment in which a person encounters only beliefs or opinions that coincide with their own. And that's what happens in silos after a while. Not only have we, what we say, been driven off people who don't listen to us anymore over there or over there, the people who are listening to us now are people who agree with us and they applaud us and it's just we're stuck there. But the information that we're getting in our silo, the information that we're getting is an echo chamber. It's the same people saying the same stuff over and over again. And by the way, they lift each other. If there's a leading voice in our echo chamber, you know what they do? They exalt another person who agrees the same way they do as another expert. I'm going to tell you a little personal story so you can understand. I grew up as a fundamental Baptist by religion. We were hardcore about a lot of weird stuff, man, in our church expression. We were just, rah. And I knew that our issues, we had several issues. And I can name any one, I can make this point with any one of our issues that I came from. I'll pick on one of them. There's like five or six I can pick on. The one I'll use is the Bible translation issue, because we preached about the Bible last week and we had some questions we answered about Bible translation issues this week. So this is a good one to bring up. One of our quirks in fundamental Baptist world was that, not that we defended the Bible, but that we defended our translation of the Bible as being the only right Bible. In fact, we defended our translation as if we were defending the Bible. And I grew up in a culture where every other person's translation, English translation of the Bible, was a perversion, which is so insulting to anybody who has a Bible. Yours is a perversion. By the way, my same people who believed that about their translation would be offended beyond words if anyone ever questioned their translation. There's an error in yours. What? You're tearing down God, you know, because to them, they deified their translation. And I grew up in a culture that and other issues, I never heard the other side. They told us, don't listen to those people, except for, here's something that they say that's ridiculous. They point out the dumb things on the other side of the issue. Isn't that crazy? And then they give us straw man arguments and say, here's how you answer that nonsense. And so I grew up thinking I knew what the other side of the Bible translation issue was about. I grew up thinking I understood the issue because in my echo chamber I heard the same people. And then they'd say, this other person's going to speak. They're an expert. You know what an expert is in an echo chamber? An expert in an echo chamber is somebody who agrees with me. We credential each other. You agree with me, so you're an expert, and you agree with me, so you're an expert. So all these experts are telling us the same things over and over again. And I heard them over and over again. I had all my arguments about how dumb these people were for thinking that way that they thought. And then one day, by the grace of God, and it's a different story for a different day, I got tossed out of my silo by the grace of God. I jumped out. I don't know. Something happened. And one day I'm sitting out there, and I'm like, holy cow. I'm looking at issues like this one and saying, I thought they had these arguments in their corner. I thought this was their angle. But actually, they have this evidence and this point and this idea. I never heard that before in my echo chamber. And it was like an eye-opener. It's like, what? Because you don't hear that information in an echo chamber. And when we're in our silos over here, and we had our tribes, and we got to beat them, because it's a zero-sum game, brother. And I got to fight them, and hey, we're right and you're wrong. What happens is this. We get stuck in silos with echo chambers of people telling us what we want to hear, and our existing views are reinforced, and alternate ideas are never considered, because all the people we keep hearing from are people parroting our same information to us in a different form. And then it feels like a big view. Then it feels like everyone sees it my way, unless they're insane. And in politics, both parties think that way. And other parties, if there are some, I guess. And it's the conspiracy theory world. The conspiracy theory world is a growing network of people who believe in all sorts of crazy stuff. Where's a lot of it coming from? People who found, in an 8 billion people world, found enough people across the globe with the same ideology they have. They got further and further in the same tribe with each other. And they have stayed in their silo and pushed everyone else away. And they're parroting the same nonsense in their echo chamber. Happens all the time to all of us so easily. And some of us are saying, not me, Arlen. Nice talk, I believe it, but I'm smarter than that. I listen to all the news. I listen to everything. I'm not that way. I listen outside of the echo chamber. Maybe you do. But here's what we all are guilty of next is confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is for those of us who are enlightened enough to actually search out things, but it's the confirmation bias is the tendency to search for, interpret, favor, and recall information that confirms or supports one's prior beliefs or values. So I'm going to search out information that's going to say, see, I was right. In fact, further, let me say it further. Confirmation bias is where we gather or remember information selectively or interpret it in a biased way. We cherry-pick data. We ignore other data. We interpret ambiguous evidence to support one's existing position. And so if we see something, we're like, that makes my point. That's good stuff right there. That isn't convenient. That must be fake. let's ignore that. Let's pick certain details. In fact, here's the crazy thing about confirmation bias that I've learned. This blows my mind. And I had to work very hard through my years to have a very big network of friends on both sides of the political aisle today, for example. So I get a lot of things. I've showed Anthony Curtis and others before on my news feed. It'll pop up sometimes. Here's a comment right here by one person about a certain event. Interpreting that event through this lens, this is right, those people are stupid, da da da. And right below it, another comment, same event, other person, other party, this is right, and those people are stupid. And they have the same event, they interpret it different ways. In fact, what's hilarious to me is I'll see people saying, this thing that happened proves that I'm right, and they're hypocritical. And someone else is like, this thing that happened, same thing, proves that we're right, and they're hypocritical. And you're like, you don't. Because what we do is we see information and we interpret it and cherry pick it and ignore and interpret things to support our existing position, to reinforce our beliefs or values. And so if it doesn't fit that, we kind of shove it aside. And if it does, we twist it to fit. And then put it back, then we bring it, and if we're not doing it, someone's doing it for us, or bring it to our echo chamber and telling us the same thing. And we're staying in our silos, trying to win the zero-sum game against the other side, because our tribe's better than their tribe, and tribe trumps truth. And I got to stop because I can go on and on and on. We could talk for a while about groupthink, but we won't because it's the same idea in different terms. But we get sucked into a day and age and a world. We get sucked into a world that is not like it was even 20 years ago. It's digital. There's more information out there than I think the human brain is ever able to absorb. We're not just trying to live our little world and our little piece of land somewhere. We are just, everything's at our fingertips. And socially, we're so connected to everybody that it's created new problems in a new day and age. And I'll tell you who's susceptible to it. Everybody. But especially, I feel like it's a struggle for young people reaching adulthood because they're walking into it without life experience. And it's also, so it's the really young, and it's also the really old, who technology is brand new, and so it's, the world's different, but you don't think in the world in different terms. You think of it the way it used to be and try to merge those into digital ideas. And those are the two categories that get the most angry, and the most stuck into silos and confirmation biases and tribes and zero-sum games and echo chambers. Because it's a different world, different problems, different temptations. Same sins, same need of a savior, different challenges. And we can talk about Facebook algorithms. I don't have time to discuss this, but let me take just a moment here and mention Facebook algorithms. Not just Facebook, but here's the thing. And I'm going to say something shocking that none of you are going to believe when I say it. You're going to be like, no way. But here's the thought. Google and Facebook and companies like that are not there out of the charity of their hearts. They're out there to make money. That's a shocking thought, I know, right? All of them are there to make money. That's their job. That's what they exist for. Now, I know they're meeting a real problem. Google's getting information to you so you can find it. And Facebook's connecting you socially. They're meeting real needs. But they saw the need and said, let's meet that need so we can monetize it. They're making money. And what they figured out a long time ago is if you can push people towards their predispositions and push them into certain lanes, they're going to stay engaged. And they stay engaged, you can sell more advertisement to viewers and you make more money. And so what happens is and this is true about everything, but let's pick on Facebook, because Facebook is the biggest social media platform and the biggest monster in some ways too. Let's talk about this for a minute. The algorithms tend to say, we want you to stay engaged, so what do we think your predispositions are politically or otherwise? And let's kind of push you that direction. Let's push you to people. Let's push information that way, your direction. Let's get you on more people. And I work hard to cultivate something that's very not that. In my own world. But it's amazing that Facebook will even look at me and say, I think more of your friends lean this way than that way, so let's kind of shove more of this into your Facebook watch section. And let's kind of push this way on you. And if you're not careful, you'll get so caught up in one viewpoint that you're like, we're right, they're the devil, what's wrong? Because we get shoved into our corners, we get shoved into our silos, we shoved into our echo chambers and our tribes. And now we gotta beat them. Because we're good, they're bad. They're evil, we're awesome. And the algorithms make it happen. And it's not because they're trying to be evil. Maybe so, but they're trying to make money. Right? It's just a money maker. And here's the thing. We get sucked into it. Hook, line, and sinker. So before long, divides become bigger. And if you don't see it my way, then you're part of the problem. And if you support someone I don't like, then you support the most evil things in the world because I can exaggerate how evil someone else is and I can exaggerate how stupid all their supporters are. We're just nuts, oh man. And somewhere lost in the middle of it all is the gospel. Did you know that nobody, this is going to shock us too, nobody gets to go to heaven? Nobody goes to heaven someday because they're a Republican or Democrat? It's like, what party are you in? Oh, that party. Trapdoor. Ah! Burn! You know? That's what some of us think, I think. But here's the thing. Here's what I want to say to you. We have somewhere along the lines lost the gospel. Somewhere along the middle of all this, we've forgotten that Jesus is the answer. That we belong to a heavenly country. We used to sing a song that says, this world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. Right? And so we've got caught up in this world, and we don't think we're worldly, but we've let the culture we live in get us all fighting the wrong battles, existing in the wrong silos, staying in the wrong echo chambers, using the wrong biases to confirm our views, fighting a zero-sum game against other tribes of people for whom Jesus died and who are not animals or crazy. They just see it differently than you do. And in this room right now, there are people in a political season on both sides of the aisle. And I say this sometimes, and I like to say this because I think it messes with some people, so I'm going to just say it anyhow to do it again. You should know that in 2016, and our leadership team at Lighthouse Church, there were people who voted for the one major party candidate, there are people who voted for the other major party candidate, and there are people who voted for neither one, all on our same leadership team. You say, how can that be? Because politics is not the point, and we don't need to line up that way. The point is Jesus Christ. If you're sitting there saying, I just can't believe I can go to a church, well, then I've outed us, so you're free to find a good church, I guess. But maybe the problem is our heart. Maybe the issue is the heart. Maybe the issue is the heart. Maybe we've let digital world we live in and the social media we live in push us so far apart that we can't stomach or believe that somebody could be, we can be close to somebody, or someone could be right with God and not share all of our ideologies, because ideology is the new geography. And the gospel is almost like, well, of course the gospel, but more important than that. And what I'm saying today is not to scold us. What I'm saying today is this, that the issue is the heart, and the heart determines what we say. And we've got to figure out what's affecting the heart. What we see and what we hear affects our heart. And we live in a different culture. And I'm tired of seeing Christians divide. I'm tired of seeing people and friendships, families fighting, people not talking to each other anymore, people insulting and treating. They would never behave that way until they got charged up on their ideologies. Christians alienating people who need Jesus because they're more concerned about someone agreeing with them and how they think the world should run than they are the fact that people need the Lord. We've lost it, man. But it's a hard issue because it's what affects us in the world we live in today. And it's heating up in 2020, and it will again, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. We got to figure it out. Because as Jesus said, whatever is in your heart determines what you say. I need 3 weeks. Give me 3 weeks before you write me off. And chew me out afterwards. Tell me how wrong I am. Tell me how smart. I understand. Give me 3 weeks. I don't expect to change anyone's. I've seen that people try to take a step before to better practices in these areas. And it sucks them right back in within a week or two. I don't have any illusions of grandeur that we're going to change the world with a sermon like this at all. But I'm hoping that somewhere one Jesus follower would start following Jesus and stop following the ways of this world. And I don't mean the ways of the world. I mean the ways of the culture that gets Christians behaving like everybody else in a non-Christ-like way. And forgetting what we're all about. If one person gets it, it's worth it all. Because whatever is in your heart determines what you say, says Jesus. Or he might say today, whatever is in your heart determines what you post, what you share, what you comment on, what you like, what you retweet. It's whatever's in your heart. If we're going to fix the problem, not bad people, good people producing bad fruit because the tree's corrupt and the tree is the heart. And the heart's corrupt not because they're bad people, but because of the input. So, if you go on Facebook today, at the top of your page where you can add your own comment, it'll say a caption and it will say, what's on your mind? I think some of us ought to think about what's on our mind. And not just what's on our mind, but we ought to think about, does the world need to know? And where's it coming from? In fact, I think we ought to ask a better question before we post what's on our mind. Maybe you ought to ask this question. What's in your heart? What's in your heart? Anger, fear of loss of how you think things should be, disgust, disdain, bitterness, hatred, animosity, discrimination. What's in your heart? Because until we fix the heart problem, we'll keep saying what's on our mind, and we'll keep driving each other further away into our silos, our tribes. We'll keep trying to win our zero-sum game. We'll keep confirming our biases, and we'll keep our echo chamber nice and echoey until we fix the heart. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk for this topic, what's in your heart, for 2 more weeks. And my hope is that when we're done, just maybe, the church can get back to being good news. The good news is what? The gospel. The gospel means good news. That's what gospel means. Good news. What's the good news? That Jesus died for our sins and was buried and rose again so we can be saved? Yes. Specifically, that God is love, and that's how he showed it. What's in our heart?